This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Good evening. It's a great honour, great pleasure to be here this evening and to talk on the topic of the shift in the balance of power. I'm not going to use too many figures, but let me just begin with some. 32, 62, 72. $32 trillion was the size of the world economy at the beginning of this century. $62 trillion was the size of the world economy the evening Lehman Brothers was going bust. And at the end of this year, even after pretty dismal growth this calendar year, the world economy will be $72 trillion. These are figures in nominal terms. Some of the growth is accounted for by inflation, but the vast bulk of that continued increase in the size of the world economy is actual economic growth led primarily by the emerging economies. Basically, despite the crisis, the world economy continues to get bigger. This evening I'm going to focus on the shift in the balance of power by looking at it from three areas. First, the economic shift. Second, the shift in the balance of power, or as it may turn out to be, not yet a shift in the balance of power in other areas. And third and finally, the implications. But first, let's begin with the current economic picture. We have a very divided and a very disconnected world economy, which is consequently leading to many policy dilemmas. One of the many messages from this crisis and from the last few years is that globalization means that everyone is impacted by what happens in another part of the world. There is contagion. And in terms of the emerging economies, a message from the beginning of this crisis, and indeed one of our mantras at Standard Chartered back in 2007, 2008, when we were very pessimistic about the West, was that emerging economies were not decoupled, but they're better insulated. I think the last few years has shown that to be the case. Global crisis hit in 2008. We had the global recession in 2009. Then the world economy basically boomed in 2010. Lots of people didn't actually realize it. World economy that year grew roughly 4.4%, led by policy stimulus in the West and led by emerging economies that accounted for 2/3 of global growth that year. But last year, the world economy was already cooling. And last year, the world economy grew around 3%, largely as the policy stimulus in the West started to wear off. And indeed, as many emerging economies, led by China and India, started to tighten policy to curb inflation. Our guess for global growth this year last December was 2.2%. We actually have 2.6% as our latest forecast. So you can see it's a pretty weak picture. But the underlying picture is also reflecting not just the cyclical factors that we've seen, but I would say there are three big structural features. One negative, one positive, and the other very much depends on which part of the world you live in. The negative is the continued debt deleveraging in the West, where, in our view, we're just over halfway through the process. The second feature, which is positive or negative, depending on where you sit, is the structural shift. President Obama's chief of staff 3.5 years ago said, let's not waste the crisis. America probably did, but many parts of the emerging world didn't. And indeed, it's quite interesting to see the extent to which many emerging economies and companies have continued to move up the value curve in the last few years. And the other structural shift is this shift in the balance of power from the West to the East. Now, whichever economy one looks at, the outcome, in my view, depends on the interaction between the fundamentals, policy, and confidence. In the West, the fundamentals are not great. Policy cupboard is almost empty, and confidence is incredibly fragile. Across the emerging world, it's very different. The fundamentals are mixed to good. The policy cupboard is pretty full, and confidence is far more resilient. Now, it's important, though, to stress that emerging economies have grown for the last few years, and they are at a very different stage of the cycle now to economies in the West. Indeed, many emerging economies are at the stage of the cycle where in the past, they probably would have run into problems, inflation or trade problems. Therefore, You shouldn't misread the current softness in many emerging economies as a sign of fundamental weakness. It's a case that the trend is up, but you should expect setbacks along the way. And I think that's particularly the case for China, as it is for a number of other of the bigger emerging economies. When one looks at these emerging economies, I would argue that we're now in the third super cycle of the modern era. People in the West tend to think I've been smoking something when I say that. But basically, there are similar historical characteristics from the last couple of hundred years that give us an indication of what's happening now across parts of the emerging world. In my view, the first super cycle, which I define as a prolonged period of strong growth lasting a generation or more, was seen in the latter part of the 19th century. From 1870 to 1913, there was a significant step up in global growth, averaging 2.8% per year in real terms. It was characterized by the emergence of America as an economic superpower when it went from the fourth to the first biggest economy in the world. And in that period, it contributed 28% of global economic growth. And also, it was reflected in other factors, such as the adoption of technologies from the Industrial Revolution, and also from other features, some of which we see in economies such as China now. Exuberance leading to credit cycles that got out of hand. The credit cycle was quite volatile in that period. Bank failures were not uncommon, particularly in the West. But the point is that that period of strong growth was very characteristic of some aspects of what we see now. The second super cycle period was 1945 until the early 70s. This was really the golden era for the world economy. In real terms, the world economy grew by, on average, 5% per annum over that period, lasting just over a quarter of a century. Japan grew 11-fold. We also saw the emergence of the Asian tigers. But at the same time, there were other factors. Naturally, a post-Second World War rebound and the growth of consumer durable markets in the West. Now, I think we are seeing a similar, significant, longer-term change. It doesn't mean everything goes up all the time. Far from it. But I think it's important not to lose sight of some of the underlying features. Big economies are now embracing globalization. Roughly three-quarters of the world's population in the last decade has started to be pulled into the global economy. Some of it's perspiration, more people doing more stuff, buying more things. Basically, the population is growing. But it's also inspiration. There's more innovation, there is more investment, there's more infrastructure spending. Indeed, it's not just in the UK that people talk about infrastructure. There's an infrastructure boom around parts of the world, the likes of which has never been seen before. But on top of that, there are some big underlying trends that we in Britain in the future, or if not already, can lock into. The scale of the economies that are becoming globalised, China in particular. I still think that in the West, people don't get it. The pace and scale of change and the catch-up potential around the world is just phenomenal. Some of the greenest factories I come across are in places like Bangladesh. We're in the India and Pakistan room. India and Pakistan aren't doing so great at the moment. But the emerging economies are seeing significant change led from the bottom upwards. Domestic market. The middle class is really emerging. Just let me quote some figures. The percentage of people that own fridges in India is 18%. In China, it's 48%. Percentage of people with TVs, this is from a year ago, so it's probably out of date already, is 56% in India, 80% in China. I can give you many other figures from other parts of the world. So the scale, the domestic economy, and also very importantly, and very important for Britain as well, new trade corridors. New trade corridors were once maybe referred to as South-South trade. It's flows of goods, of commodities, of people, of remittances, and of portfolio and direct investment flows. Asia-Africa, Asia-Middle East, Asia-Latin American trade. And then on top of this, cash and financial resources, helping drive the underlying changes, but also consequence of it. And to conclude the first part, one key aspect of all of this is greater or growing global interconnectedness, not just in the sense of contagion from one country to another, but particularly in the corporate sphere. And it's difficult to say exactly how this will continue to materialise, but we saw evidence last year of how the Japan quake or the floods in Thailand had a major disruptive effect on global supply chains. We have greater geographical specialization and location of activities. In essence, it's a very hyper interconnected world, and the growth and continued growth of IT and the internet is likely to continue to see that in the future. So in economic terms, there is a shift already well underway in the balance of economic and financial power. I think we've already seen evidence of that in recent years during this crisis, and I think we'll continue to see evidence of it in coming decades. But what about other aspects in terms of the shift in the balance of power? Normally, economic power facilitates the accumulation of other sorts of power: military, political, financial, even soft power. However, economic power need not automatically translate into these other areas. And one of the interesting aspects of this shift, in my view, in the balance of power, is that we've not yet seen it in all these other areas. In the past, we did, when Britain emerged and became the major power, when America emerged and became the major power. So let me go through briefly some of these other areas. The financial shift. I think we are already seeing evidence of a shift in financial power. So in my view, the economic shift is taking place. In financial terms, there is evidence. I think this is both a driver of what's happening to the world economy and also a consequence of it. It is, however, very complex, both across countries and within countries. Within countries, Gini coefficients continue to suggest rising inequality. What's remarkable, though, is that in economies in the emerging world, rising inequality is not yet seen as a major issue politically or seen as a major obstacle to continued growth. Why? In my view, it's because the cake is still getting bigger. People just want to have a slice of that cake, even if someone else gets a bigger slice of it. At some stage, though, difficult to say when an economic cake gets big enough, there are other social issues that come to the fore. And we've seen that in the West. The economic cake is not getting bigger. Therefore, politicians play to the domestic audience in order to be re-elected. Hence, we've seen a regulatory burden, particularly on the financial sector, and we've seen basically changes take place in the West. Another big shift, though, that's already taking place, and will be interesting to see whether it continues to be copied in the West, as I think it is the role and the rise of the state. I remember writing an article in the FT back in 1997 that I thought the rise of state capitalism would be one of the key trends of coming years. And Bob Kimmett, who was then number two at the US Treasury, wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs a few years later talking about the four sovereigns: sovereign wealth funds, government pension funds, foreign exchange reserves, and also, very importantly, state-owned enterprises. The role of the state is very important in understanding how many emerging economies approach things. State-run organizations tend to be strategic as opposed to driven just by competition. They tend to be more opaque rather than transparent. In essence, they can change the rules of the game. What has been interesting, in my view, about the growth of sovereign wealth funds has been the way in which the West has tried to engage with many of the holders and people who run sovereign wealth funds. And out of this, the Santiago principles has taken hold. But the role of the state has certainly become more important. There is also another shift in terms of the financial aspect, and that's the way in which overseas money is coming out of the emerging economies, or put it another way, they're investing outside their home countries. Let's put it another way. In the last decade, the three words most commonly seen anywhere in the world were made by China. The three words you're likely to see most commonly in the next decade will be owned by China. China is leading a surge of foreign direct investment from many different aspects or parts of the emerging world. Tata, who are a client of Standard Chartered, for instance, are the biggest manufacturer in the UK. I remember speaking to them many years ago about why the UK was such an attractive place to invest in. What one sees from across the emerging world is more companies buying up assets, buying up intellectual property rights, buying where they can brands to move overseas. The Chinese, actually, the Chinese commerce minister a few months ago on the record, you may have seen him, but he said this on the record, not just off the record. He viewed continental Europe as having a Cold War approach to Chinese investment. Continental Europe was blocking Chinese investment in areas such as high tech, agriculture, and nuclear. In contrast, the UK was seen as being very open. The question for the Chinese has always been in recent years whether they should continue as they have had a passive approach to investing in the UK, for instance, buying Thames Water, or a stake in Thames Water, or whether they should become more proactive. But the point is, foreign direct investment is coming out of the emerging world. In contrast, one of the big questions in the West is the extent to which portfolio investment will go from the West to the East. Surveys show that international investors in the West are underinvested across the emerging world. In fact, the region of the emerging world that investors want to invest the most in is Africa. It's also the place that they're most underinvested in. This, however, is a challenge not just for Africa, but many emerging economies do not yet have capital markets that are deep enough or broad enough. Indeed, after the global crisis at the annual Asian Development Bank meeting in 2008, one of the key themes was what does Asia need to do to move from export-led to domestic-led growth? Three things were identified: social safety nets to stop people saving too much, help to SMEs, small, medium-sized enterprises, to create the jobs needed, and also, very importantly, deeper and broader bond markets, which you could take further into deeper and broader capital markets. The UK is incredibly well-placed if emerging economies continue to follow through on what I think is a necessary part of their development. And the final aspect may be in terms of the financial side, where there is a shift, but this part hasn't taken place, is that within all the talk of the reform of the international monetary system, the big question is what happens to global currencies. Before this crisis, many people did say that if there was to be a crisis, it would be a dollar crisis. What happened when the crisis hit? People trusted the dollar. They trusted the depth and breadth of US financial instruments. They trusted the legality and the certainty of US assets. But despite that, the dollar still has many questions about its future relative to, say, the potential growth of the CNY. In the past, emerging economies would tie their currencies to the dollar largely to gain the credibility of the Fed. No longer are people seeking that as the necessary way to go in the future. Moreover, the changing trade flows that I touched on earlier, new trade corridors, means, in my view, that more countries will, in the future, tie their currency to a basket of currencies with which they trade. This is likely to see a shift over time, gradually, not dramatically, in the way in which people view global currencies. And one of the big issues, therefore, is the rising internationalisation of the CNY. And this time a year ago, Chancellor George Osborne ensured that London was seen as the offshore centre of the CNY outside of Asia. So in terms of other shifts, I think there is a shift partially or already underway in terms of financial power. But in policy-making power, I do not think there has been. In fact, when I look at the shift in the world economy, I would tend to say that you can look at it in five aspects. The economic shift that I've touched on, the financial shift I've just mentioned, but the other three parts are policy-making, or political, military, and soft power. And let me comment on these. I don't think there is yet a shift in policy or political-making power globally. I think the West still, in many respects, rules the roost. The World Bank and the IMF are having minor technical changes in terms of voting rights, but really they are still very much under the influences of the US and Western Europe. Basically, the IMF could already be seen as a bailout fund for Europe. The United Nations also hasn't fundamentally changed, but that's more reflective of the changing world economy. In fact, Britain, being a member of the UN Permanent Five, I think is probably a member of the most important club globally, although I don't think we in the UK appreciate how important being a member of the United Nations Security Council is. I think we should actually try and vote differently from the US as often as we can if we disagree with them. Obviously, we should basically do what's in our own as well as the global longer-term best interest. The challenge, I think, is that China, and many other emerging economies do not really play the role that they should on these global forums. In terms of the UN, for instance, China often vetoes or abstains from major decisions in the name of sovereignty and non-interference. In my view, their appetite needs to change. But it's not just them. During this crisis, we saw G20 effectively replace G7. G20, set up after the Asian crisis with finance ministers, became a head of state grouping. G20 did well in this crisis at the London summit. Now, some people would say that shows that G20 works. I would actually say it's more reflective of the fact that global policy coordination works when it's in everyone's best interests. We saw global policy coordination's heyday with the Louvre and the Plaza Accord in 1985 to 1987, when the attempt was to change global currency trends. Global policy coordination worked at the London summit. But over and above that, I don't think G20 has really evolved properly. In fact, it's more than G20. 28 people sit around the table. Maybe G7, G8 was too small. G20 or G28 seems too big. Moreover, G7 moved from being just a group that just focused on the economy to focusing on other political issues. Maybe that's also what needs to happen with the G20 or whatever turns up to be more effective in the future. Finally, the G2 is often said to be the key driver. Maybe the most important word President Obama used in the last 4 years was "and." He changed the relationship with China from a strategic economic partnership to a strategic and economic partnership. And I think that strategic one is very important in understanding the next shift in military terms. I do not think there is a shift in military power yet, but it's interesting to watch some of the potential trouble spots in the next few years. US military spending, the figures aren't exactly clear always on this, they're sometimes complicated, but as far as I can make out, America spends as much as the next 14 countries put together on military spending. America is cutting its military spending each year for the next decade by what turns out to be the size of the Japanese military budget for each year, although Japan's military budget, as you all know, is pretty small. China's economy is roughly half that of the US. Its military spending is 1/6. On current trends, China's military spending will equal that of the US by 2025. But having the largest military spend is one thing. Having the most effective is far more important. America's military spend is in a different league. It acts as a deterrent, or you could say influences people in other ways. Having said that, it's still lost a lot of its effectiveness, the very fact that they can't effectively have a winning victory in Afghanistan or Iraq would suggest there are wider questions. But in a nutshell, military capability is a key issue. In the last year, I think we've seen a major change. Last November, the US used the word pivot. As far as I was told in Washington, this caused more reaction from European politicians in the next 24 hours than anything else that President Obama has said in the last few years. Hence, the Americans have not used the word pivot so much since. But effectively, last November, they were saying that they were going to pivot the military capability, in a nutshell, away from Europe towards Asia Pacific. And I think that very much resonates with the fact that they are boosting their economic engagement and their commercial engagement with Asia. In terms of Asia itself, this is the big trouble spot. The South China Sea in particular. China in the last 3 months has sent two major military people to the US. One was the defense minister in May, and the other was 2 weeks ago, the deputy chief of the general staff of the People's Liberation Army. He was there to primarily talk about the dispute with Japan over the Diaoyu Islands. America and Japan have recently started the 37-day military drill in Western Pacific, which one of the Japanese officials said was to be a practice to get back the Diaoyu Islands. I'm not sure if they will do that, but more attention in Asia is focused on the South China Seas and the disputes over the Spratly Islands and the Paracel Islands. The Chinese see the South China Seas as the new Persian Gulf. They believe there are as much resources there as in the Persian Gulf. The Americans and the Europeans do not agree with that, but I don't think that will stop this region becoming a major focus in political and regional terms, and that's where the big potential trouble spot will be in the next few years. On top of that, I'm still perplexed by whether Germany is having a closer relationship with Russia or not. At Davos this year, Chancellor Merkel talked enthusiastically about this, although from what I can make out, still Germany's institutions are not that friendly towards Russia. But I think it's very important for us here in the UK to understand this, because it's potentially very important for the whole energy debate here in the UK. Finally, in terms of this section, soft power. Soft power is the ability to attract rather than coerce. The US has abundance of this, but so too does Britain. It's often said that there's two aspects to soft power. One is when people copy you, and the other is education. Education is seen as the biggest seen as a major indicator of soft power, as people want to buy into your values, your knowledge, and emulate you. The UK, as well as the US, are still the major education hubs at the higher end, even though we have a two-tier system effectively on the ground in the UK. But we must make sure we don't score any own goals there. Also, soft power across Africa. I was struck back at the end of 2010 seeing CCTV, China's TV company, building a major, and when I say major, I probably should say massive TV centre in Nairobi to broadcast to Africa in English to make up for the fact that the BBC World Service, no less, was probably putting out of Africa. So soft power is one of these important areas we should not underestimate. But to conclude the second part, in financial terms, there's a shift. In military terms, I don't think there's a shift. In policy, political terms, I don't think there's a shift. And in soft power, I don't think there's a shift. Third and finally, what are the implications? I think we should view this shift in the balance of power as a positive. The economic cake is going to get bigger. In my view, it's not just a case of thinking the West does badly and the East does well. That's nonsense. Emerging economies have major challenges. Not least is the fact that some of the things we take for granted in the West, emerging economies don't have in terms of their institutional framework. So emerging economies, the trend is up, but there will be setbacks along the way. In the West, I think the economies that will continue to benefit from this shift in the balance of power are those that have one of the three C's, or at least one of the three C's, the cash, the commodities, or the creativity. We don't have much cash at the moment in Britain. Commodities, well, Scotland wants to have most of the ones that we do have. But we still do lead on creativity and innovation. But the shift in the balance of power is not without its challenges. Environmental, energy, bigger players mean bigger tensions. And while there might be winners as well as losers, sometimes even the winners might not be happy if they're a relative loser to someone else. One of the areas that the UK will undoubtedly be impacted by, and in my view still already is in terms of commodity prices. Commodity prices have, in my view, a firm floor and a soft ceiling. The firm floor is the underlying demand from across the emerging world. The soft ceiling is the fact that geopolitical risks could push energy prices up or supply disruption, food prices up. The hike in commodity prices ahead of the crisis did play an impact in weakening the US and to a lesser extent the UK economy back in 2007-08. That spike up in commodity prices then highlighted that there had been a lack of investment previously in many commodity producing regions. The credit crunch and financial crisis delayed any inward investment into many commodity producing regions, but since then there's been a clamour to produce more. China is leading the resource buy-up. Russia also is engaging in it. There are three ways out of this: prices, output, or technology. Prices adjust as they are. Output adjusts as more investment eventually leads to higher output. And sometimes you get a big change then as commodity prices fall back down, and technological advancements. But the underlying message is that I think here in the UK, we should assume that commodity prices will not be the shock absorber that they were previously when we in the UK and in the West had periods of economic difficulty. In previous periods of economic difficulty, when economies in the West were doing poorly, energy and other commodity prices were tended to be weak. Now these are driven, it seems to me, more by the cycles across the emerging world and less so by what's happening here in the West. A reform agenda has to be a consequence of this shift in the balance of power. It's not just in the West, but also in the East. When I look at infrastructure, I tend to talk about hard infrastructure, road, rail, internet, soft infrastructure, skills and education, but also institutional infrastructure. One of the things emerging economies don't really have, and indeed one of the things I think we take for granted here in the UK, is the institutional setup. China, for instance, is now a very big economy, yet it's still effectively run as if though it was a much smaller economy, run from Beijing. So we shouldn't underestimate the reform agenda that still needs to take place across the emerging world. Indeed, India in the last year, where the politicians are pretty ineffective, where corruption has come to the fore, is an indication of that. But also in the West, reform is essential, particularly in Europe. Europe is seen in Asia as a declining part of the world economy, even though Europe, for instance, is the biggest trading partner with China. So there is a bit of a difference between people's future perceptions of Europe and where Europe is at the moment. Europe's population will shrink to 8% of the global economy by 2050. But the big reform for Europe has to be in its social model. When Bismarck introduced the pension age in Germany at the latter part of the 19th century, life expectancy was 59 and pension age was set at 70. Eventually it was lowered to 65, pension age. America copied. When America introduced its pension age at 65, I think in the 20s, life expectancy was around 62. As we saw a few months ago, President Hollande, elected in France, lowered the pension age for some people down towards 60. Europe's social model is basically unaffordable. We need to reform. The other issue is up the value curve is the best way to think about it. In the West, we tend to think that high-value jobs will come here. They don't necessarily have to. Indeed, let's just take China. When China had its first five-year plan in 1953, it focused on the 156 Soviet-aided projects. I gave a talk at the Treasury a couple of months ago, and I pointed out to them that the 12 five-year plan last year introduced in China identified seven strategic industries, but a couple of these are industries where we in the UK think we should be exporting heavily to China. China thinks they need to be doing it themselves. Alternative energy, energy conservation and environmental protection, biotech, advanced materials, new IT, high-end manufacturing, clean energy. The challenge is in the UK to remain competitive enough at the top end, whilst accepting at the same time that we need lots of low-skill as well as high-skill jobs. The other challenge from all of this for international investors is what is a risk-free asset. During the crisis in the West, government spending has risen from on average 75% of GDP to 110%. As the Bank for International Settlements pointed out in their annual report, central banks' balance sheets, including China, has to be said, are now just over $18 trillion, 30% of global GDP. No one's quite sure if that's a good figure or a bad figure, but it's twice as high as it used to be a few years ago. And some of the papers around Jackson Hole last week were talking about the moral hazard and unintended consequences of all of this. But it does make it difficult for international investors as to what constitutes a risk-free asset. Is it a government bond in the West? Or is it an emerging market asset where you could argue all the risk is already priced in? What does it mean finally for the UK? I think Britain's biggest export is its pessimism. We are always pessimistic all the time about everything, it seems to me. I think we should view this shift in the balance of power as a phenomenal opportunity. I do, however, think that we need some longer-term strategic thinking to navigate the changing world. It doesn't mean that we need to have the government telling us to do what to do, but I do think we need some longer-term economic plans. I think the government is right that we need to be selling more into the emerging economies, and we are, although some people would argue that we've not really leveraged enough off our Commonwealth and other connections. But I think the most important thing, rather than going down that avenue, is to make sure that we create the right environment here at home in which we can succeed. Innovation is going to be a key success. Creativity. In a nutshell, we need to make the UK a great place to do business. We need to, for instance, tap into the foreign students coming here without putting visas in their place. Globalisation suggests that taxes need to be kept low on things that are mobile, such as capital and things that are high-skilled. Taxes need to go up on things that are static, such as housing. London is the global city. Yet, over the course of the Olympics, one of the big groups that was courted, shall we say, was the Chinese Entrepreneurs Group. They, between them, own 7% of the Chinese economy, the private sector. And I was speaking on the lunch at the last day, and the leader of the group was asked what was his takeaway from the last 3 days in London. And he said, we had discussed that, he said, the Chinese group the night before, and he said, we didn't realise how open the UK economy was. Therefore, maybe we need to make sure that we get our message across more to other parts of the world. Think less about Europe, and think more about global. I was in the No campaign, and one of the interesting things that came out in the No campaign was when we did this assessment of, what do you call it when you get people in the room, can't think what you called it now. Focus groups, sorry. The focus groups came out with a very interesting conclusion. This was back 12, 15 years ago. Over 65s were basically very anti the euro, these roughly speaking, that age group, for historical reasons. 35 to 65 year olds were pro it because they saw Britain as being in terminal decline. But the thing that surprised everyone was the younger people, then defined as under 35 year old, were anti the euro, not because they were anti the euro, but they were anti joining it, or not as pro it as you might have thought, because they were thinking more global. And I think maybe that's a key message we need to be thinking still here in the UK. And the final point is really that last few years has seen a shift away from the Washington consensus, the laissez-faire, towards the Beijing consensus of more government interaction. Maybe somewhere in the middle is the best solution, and I don't see why we can't be articulating here in the UK a London consensus that not only positions the UK well in the shift in the balance of power, but also is a model for others to start to emulate in the future. So thank you for your time. I've looked at three areas: the shift in the balance of economic power, second, the shift in the other areas, and third and finally, the implications. But maybe the takeaway is that this should not be seen as a negative. The global economic cake, in my view, is going to get bigger, and the countries in the West that will do well will be those that have the cash, the commodities, or the creativity. And I think Britain has a lot of the creativity, provided we get the macroeconomic picture right in the next few years. Thank you.